mean, long term, we need to get everyone to understand that a secure internet is in everyone's best interest. That it's not us versus them. That it's a secure internet versus a vulnerable internet. Right? That turns a zero-sum game into a positive-sum game and actually makes political solutions possible. So once you do that, you have laws and treaties to support it, you have technologies to support the legal regime, and you have laws and technologies to deal with non-compliant actors.
Crypto cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier, speaking recently at a conference of the Internet Engineering Task Force. And that concludes today's NSA Monitoring edition of Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. We welcome your comments, leaks, suggestions, and ideas with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
And that program was brought to you with portions on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Now, Robert Knight's program ended at 1:30, not 1:30:01, not 1:29:59. He timed it perfectly. Me, well, not so much. Even there, it's like, okay, let's try that again. If I could cue up the Rolling Stones, I would, so that we would segue with the dramatic howl of a wolf, or as we were saying earlier, the Hour of the Wolf of Wall Street. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Normally, first program of the year is a music spectacular, but given our facilities here, I don't see how I was even going to do segues. So instead, we're going to do a end of the year, beginning of the year discussion with mostly talk about stuff that came out in December. Her, Who, Hobbit. Stay tuned. With me, and I, by the way, am Jim Freund, with me are Terrence Taylor and Dan Persons. We are joined by Amy Goldschlager via email. She was going to be here largely to talk about the Who segment. But basically, what I wanted to do this week was talk about... I have strong opinions about the finale, the Matt Smith finale of Doctor Who, and the desolation of Smaug, which are more technological problems than I had than movie problems, which I will get to in a while, because the problem is couldn't see the movie because we went for everything. But
You went for HFR, didn't you?
I liked the HFR.
You fool!
I liked it. I thought it was
Except
very
you crisp. Watched it like Alex in Clockwork Orange.
Exactly.
So I think there's a price
you
to
pay.
You
cannot move your head in an HFR IMAX 3D, of which is only one theater in New York, running that three-way combination. So yeah, let's talk about Hobbit first. Fine. No, second. But first, this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction. I hope everybody can read this. January 7th, our readers will be Sam J. Miller and Jennifer Marie Brissett. You are not allowed to be a writer today, Terrence, if you don't have three... What's your middle initial?
M.
M?
M. Terrence Michael.
Terrence, and I like Terrence Taylor.
It's 13 got, letters, it's my lucky a, number.
It's
got an alliterative ring
a
to it. It's
to
easy
it.
To remember.
Yes. Easy for you.
Well,
and me.
It has to be.
But
me.
Then I discover people call you Terry, and it's like, gee, I never heard him called Terry.
That's pre-LA. Those are pre-LA friendships.
Oh, okay.
I became Terrence in Los Angeles. I grew into my name.
Ah, okay.
Or aged into
it's
it
a
like
freeway.
Cheese. Or
at any rate, this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m., doors open at 6:30, at either the Soho Gallery for Digital Art or the Soho Art House, depending on whether you're talking to the owner or the woman who's producing all the events there. It's one way or the other. It's 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and the street formerly known as Prince. And the readers are way cool, and I'm proud of myself. They are both short story writers, except that Jen has just sold a novel. But let me read you their bios. Jennifer Marie Brissett is a Jamaican-British-American born in London who came to the U.S. when she was four, grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was a software engineer and web developer for many years before she moved to Brooklyn, New York to build the indie bookstore Indigo Cafe and Books, which she ran for 3.5 years. And may I say, that was a way cool bookstore. I went there for a reading with Octavia Butler and another with Nalo Hopkinson. And it was just a warm, friendly place, you know, a truly multicultural shop. And I really enjoyed it. But the store did not maintain the economic necessities to stay alive. I'm going to skip all of her MFA stuff and get to her stories. Can be found in Morpheus Tales, Warrior Wise Woman 2, The Future Fire, Thaumatrope, and Halfway Down the Stairs, where her work was nominated for the Zank Best of the Web series and included in the best of Halfway Down the Stairs. Her story, Secrets of the Sea, is a 2013 finalist for the Story South Million Writers Award. And by the way, I was the kingmaker of that award. On two occasions, we discovered that writers were gaming that award. It's a web-based award. Click here, mm-hmm. You know, vote early, vote often. And a gentleman who will be on this show next week, I believe, by the name of Mr. Bose, Rick Bose, was up for that and discovered that there were a couple of other people actually gaming it. You know, having all of their friends come in and going to different computers so they wouldn't match the IP addresses. So I went on the air, and I told people, they're gaming the damn award. Vote for Richard Bose. And he won. He went from, like, position 5 to 1 overnight, and he won the award. The next year...
So congratulations for out-gaming the gamers.
Yeah, exactly. And the next year, well, it was only one person, one vote. One organism,
Vote. Okay.
As Walt Kelly used to say, Farsighting Theater, one organism, one vote. Farsighting Theater. Papoon for President.
Ah, okay. That's the one
or
I don't know.
Actually, Papoon for Resident. That's... From the Martian Space Party, which is actually a movie, not a record. Yeah. But at any rate, the next year I ran into Kat Valenti at ReaderCon, and she said, I understand that you can be had for sugar-free chocolate. And I said, had in what sense? Said I, accompanying Barbara. And she said, I'm up for the Million Writers Award, the Story South Million Writers Award. And once again, but only by a narrow margin. And the next year, like 5 friends of mine were nominated. And I have stopped. And, you know,
well, you don't want to play favorites.
But it was like only one person who I knew. Mm. Only one person who was a friend. That was one thing. But... when it's like multiple friends, you know, there you stop. And
with
I don't
great
know
power comes great responsibility.
Indeed. And my tingling is going there, yes. So I don't know who... warn me before you do that.
Yeah, sorry about that. I assume you cut my mic off any given chance anyway, so...
No, that'll come soon.
yes, Mr. O'Reilly.
Yes. I'm not Irish. Anyway, her debut novel, Elysium.
Huh.
Don't you think they should change the title?
Probably
will be
now.
Published in spring 2014 by Aqueduct Press. Dan, quickly, Elysium, up or down?
I would say up. It was not as good as District 9. The problem with Elysium for me was what it was promoted as, which was you thought it was going to be this adventure on the space station. It turned out most of the story was about getting to the space station. And it was
so it's the opposite of Gravity.
Yeah, pretty much that.
Getting off what was the space station.
Yeah.
Yes. Oop, spoiler. Okay, so Sam J. Miller is our other reader. He's a writer and community organizer. Oh, come on. Let's be straight about this. He organizes queer readings, okay, which does not mean that you have to have a funny stomach walking in. And as I pointed out, I hate the Q word because of
never heard it referred to as funny stomach, though, like odd. Well, like he's a bit
Tolkien
queer.
Uses the word queer.
But my tummy's a bit queer. I've never heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that.
usage.
Must be an odd cultural thing. Well, common perhaps in your circles. Obviously not in mine, but I'd never...
Well, we're of an age, similar age, so...
Yeah, but evidently growing up on Air Force bases and being bounced around, I just missed that one.
Yeah. But no, that was always there. I mean, there's also, you know, there's something queer about this. There's something...
Well,
you,
and
there was, I mean, Lovecraft was for, well, not weird fiction, but queer fiction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I know in that context, just digestive. I'd never heard it.
Yeah.
As a
but yeah, yeah. No, I just, it's just, I feel queer. Is another way of saying that you're slightly dizzy, not altogether there.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you see, when I was growing up in Queens, the Q word was only a pejorative.
It was very specific.
It was very specific, and it was never used in a positive way. And young people, damn them all, I turned 63 days ago. Young people say, "Oh, they're reclaiming the word."
And I remember Queer Nation, and
they
actually tried to leap up in the background of a live
keep talking
pledge drive, and had a big banner they're going to hold up, and we got cued to this and stopped them, but it was all very amusing. All the queers at 13 stopping Queer Nation from, like, doing an act up.
Well, you know, I think if we can reclaim geek and nerd, I think they are certainly welcome to
reclaim. Well, nerd is a reclaim. Geek was also always pejorative.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, that's...
But,
I mean, that's
but I always called myself a geek and a nerd.
But, I mean, those are the only ones that, I don't know, I think deserve reclaiming. I mean, the N-word, as everyone calls it, because no one wants to say the actual word anymore, has been overused so much by the hip-hop community that it's become, if not meaningless, but just irritating to
And reggae. Not so much reggae as ska.
I just get very tired of hearing, you know, little
but
white
I still,
kids on the subway calling each other that.
It's I feel queer.
I don't care how backward
stomach.
Your baseball cap is, god damn it.
So when I had Sam on the show, and and this was when he produced the queer reading at not Blue Bottle, Blue Stocking Books. And I was saying, can't we say it's gay? You know, he said, but, why? We're happy. I said, I certainly hope so. And
not all.
And I simply said Q word was out of my comfort zone. And he said, well, it's a word that we embrace. I said, okay, fine. Yeah. But know that I'll use it. It's fine in promoting your event. I will not use it in casual conversation. But do know that it's out of my comfort zone. And to me, it's as bad as calling somebody a boop or a you know, it's
of purges.
It hits me hard.
Well, it's because you grew up with it in that way, and that's
exactly.
why. I mean, I grew up with nigger in that way, and it was like you did not call people that. Just so those who may not know, I am of African American. I am allowed to use this. I just feel like we are on radio, and
yes, but you can't say that you're black.
I actually do consider myself black.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, of course.
I wasn't very fond of African American. My ancestors were far too indiscriminate. There are so many.
You've
things.
Got lots. Well,
I'm a mud. I'm an American mud. And black encompass
that.
Oh, absolutely. That's what a lot of us refer to ourselves as. I mean, I have Indian, Scottish. Evidently, it's a hell of a lot of Scottish blood in this.
Yeah, where did
my
the
brother
name Taylor come from?
Well, that's the weird thing. But I never I knew that there was a specific person on my mother's side, but I didn't know my father's side until my brother got a DNA test and they did the mitochondrial thing, and we're 12% Scottish on my father's side. And it was like, where did that come from?
What broke me out of the politically correct African American situation is that I was writing about an actor of African origin who was British, and I was starting to write African American.
By reflex. Yeah, wait.
Yeah. Yeah, what do I do now?
Yeah, it's their. I tend to use black.
I like black. Black is absolute. Yeah. It goes with everything.
Yeah. Black is the
you
new
know,
black.
It's black. It was the new black. And I grew up with black is beautiful. It was a very strong political statement at the point that
very
I was growing
up. Very much so.
And I embraced
WBAI.
It. And, you know, I felt that African American was a PR stunt come
H.
up with
Raff
by a handful
Julius
of people
Lester.
Who threw it at us, and none of us had a vote in it. And it was like everyone started using it because if any five black people say something, all white people have to do that. Evidently.
And I noticed that if Jen Brissett
loud
doesn't
enough
say that she's black. Jennifer Marie Brissett says she's a Jamaican British American.
Well, that's a whole other topic.
Yeah, she's also but Sam J. Miller.
Those of us from that part of the world tend to not view ourselves as black.
Down,
but,
he is a
but
community
Caribbean.
Organizer. He's very involved in rainbow triangle politics. Where are politics?
There's a great deal. That's a whole other...
He's a great guy. He's a good writer. Both of these are really good writers. His
Jennifer is actually in my writing group, I feel I should point out. And Barbara's.
That's right.
She is. We love her writing.
Yes. His work.
Full disclosure.
Appeared or is forthcoming in Shimmer, Electric Velocipede. There's going to be an Electric Velocipede reading that Sam is organizing, in fact, at Blue Stocking at the end of January.
Lovely, lovely.
And I will help promote that at the time. Barbara is one of the readers.
Very.
That's Barbara Krasnoff, by the way. Nightmare Magazine. Oh, full disclosure. I am the podcast editor of Nightmare Magazine, and I am the host, I think I've announced this once, of the sister magazine, Lightspeed Magazine, which is a podcast created by John Joseph Adams. And the voice people there are Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure, and I have edited Claire Bloom and people like, I mean, it's like cool stuff. And I had better finish my Jeremiah Tolbert story it goes up Tuesday. Anyway, Daily Science Fiction, the Minnesota Review, and the Rumpus, among others. He's a graduate of the 2012 Clarion Writers Workshop. I told you he was a kid. And a member, he's probably like, you know, maybe 30. A member of the Altered Fluid Writers Group. Now, that really annoyed me because I was going to recommend him for your writers group.
Well.
And the co-editor of Horror After 9/11, an anthology published by the University of Texas Press and included in the brilliant/lowbrow quadrant of New York Magazine's famed Approval Matrix. It's so famous, I've never heard of it.
Matrix.
We will have a raffle. Admission is free, but either Terrence or Amy Goldschlager will
be raffled off. My God,
try to get donations.
Can we go back to the earlier conversation on race? No, we don't do that with us anymore.
What?
Raffle us off.
Raffle, not auction.
Only if we get, I can't.
It's okay to raffle, that's true. Auctioning is out. Yeah. But raffling, you can certainly raffle black people.
Best horror movie of the year.
Which was?
12 Years a Slave.
I haven't.
How many people have told that?
I have not gotten a screener from the Writers Guild for that. I have not gotten an invitation to a screen. I have to open up a few envelopes. Maybe there is one. But I want to see this desperately. And I can't imagine it's going to be any less horrifying to me than Gravity was for very different reasons. But I'll walk out with much
we'll
the same feeling.
Moment. Let me finish the opening promo, which will only take 5 minutes.
Go ahead.
We're now 21 minutes into the show. Again! That's the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at 138 Sullivan Street. Sam J. Miller, Jennifer Marie Brissett, this coming Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30, and I hope to see you there. For more information, you can go to Facebook and join the NYRSF, NYRSF Readings Group, or go to ourwolf.com and follow the links to NYRSF Readings, and you'll get all kinds of illustrated, which you can't do on Facebook, stuff about the writers.
And will that notice be posted on the doorway of Town Hall in addition?
No, but there will be a town crier walking in the city. Oh, at 12 a.m.
Can't stand the town crier. So annoying.
So full of himself.
Such a bummer.
Just because he has a big voice.
Well, I mean, town crier, wasn't that Alexander Wolcott?
Yes, it was. Yes, you're right.
The town crier?
The town crier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not in the...
What is it? Book review. Weird out of left field trivia.
Yes.
The cartoon book review from Looney Tunes had a section edited out of it that originally had Wolcott as the town crier at the beginning of the film because Wolcott objected.
They used him in a lot of Looney Tunes as an owl. Usually,
yeah, yeah, but in that particular case, he was a
hated person among the Algonquin Roundtable people.
He was also the lead character
of The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Yes,
yes,
yes.
Monty Woolley was without question Wolcott.
Yeah.
Down to including Monty Woolley's look, you know, and how it's why he got both the Broadway show and the movie.
Because he looked like Wolcott. What a curse. What a blessing.
And he could talk like him, which is what he does throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I have to
I personally sided with him for
it's
most
got
of that
penguins.
Movie.
Penguins.
Well, everything
well, that's because they make the
you.
Host so terrible. But
well, they're all horrible people, and he was right to deny them.
Yes, but what about Bette Davis, who was wrong for that part? Imagine Barbara Stanwyck in that same part, or even better.
Of the secretary?
The secretary.
I haven't seen the movie in so long, I forgot it was Betty Davis.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it was Betty Davis.
Yeah, me too,
as a matter of fact.
Gene Arthur would have been my choice for that role.
Mm. Yeah.
Gene Arthur.
Much more sympathetic. A little more edge.
Much more sympathetic.
Bette Davis, she just... Well, the problem is the script doesn't give her the edge.
Yeah.
You know, it's the edge, the woman who comes out in the letter shooting people, she just wasn't right for that. She could play any role. But Gene Arthur or Stanwyck, who were semi-interchangeable and were interchanged by Frank Capra, dropped one, picked up the other.
Good old Frank.
Better for the role. At any rate, and Wolcott was a raving anti-Semite. Which, given that a good majority of the members of the Algonquin Roundtable were Jewish.
Devotedly Jewish.
So there's the story. Dorothy Parker's father was Jewish and mother not, or other way around. In Jewish law, if her mother's Jewish,
you're Jewish.
But she was half Jewish.
That wasn't then. That had been established.
And Wolcott made some kind of an anti-Semitic remark. And Georges Kaufman got up and he said, at this point, I am leaving the room and I trust Miss Parker will walk me halfway.
Very nice.
I love the round table.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Ah, the lubrication of liquor and wit.
If a quarter of the stories are true.
Doesn't matter. By virtue of the fact that they're what's told, they are true.
Yes, exactly.
The fact that they even spawn those stories, even if they took time to write them later, still validates
their existence. And I worked for a gentleman who was a member.
I feel wittier every time I have a drink in the lobby of the Algonquin.
Yes.
I go there periodically with my friend Eve, and we sit there. There's the Blue Bar, but the Blue Bar now is not the old Blue Bar.
No, the room.
Oh, it's the Oak Room.
Yes.
In the back.
Yes.
I had brunch there the weekend that we saw the Anna Nicole opera. We met my friend was staying, and so we had brunch there, and it was very, very pleasant. It's you know, they modernized it a bit, but it's still...
Has
enough of the roots of the old
Algonquin
tour.
Yes.
I always liked the old decor.
But I have been told a
but I miss
secret
the old Blue Bar.
Which I can't say on the air.
Oh, well. Put on a song, Jim.
It comes to this. Basically, I don't know if it's true any longer, but it was many years ago, that writers get a discount.
I've never heard of that.
On the room, yeah.
God. You had to, bring in your book with your picture on the cover or something?
You've
got to
pretty
be
much
a damn well-known writer.
Yes.
No dilettantes guy.
But I had a couple of people on
the So just pulling up the Huffington Post and going, look here.
Exactly.
Look here, buddy.
Bloggers.
don't.
What if I tossed a couple of copies of my novel on the tray? If I could get a discount on the drinks.
Actually,
there,
well, God knows
the amount spend just on appetizers and a drink.
It's not eating or drinking.
I'm sure it's only.
It's for rooms.
Believe me, a lot of their income is from the literary scene piling in after 6 o'clock every night. So
yeah,
they're not discounting that.
The discount, and this is like a 20-year-old story. It's probably no longer true.
I'm sure SB ownership has shifted so much.
But I am aware.
But there was a day when they respected the rights of the poor writer.
Yeah. But they gave the same rights to the rich writer.
screw the rich writer.
So, which did we say we're going to start with? Smaug.
Smaug, yes, that's right. Yeah, so you want to.
Which you reviewed on the program 2 weeks ago.
That's right.
So, my problem was a technological one. You've got three basic add ons that you know, first you've got the Desolation of Smaug.
Which I've started to think of as like a name for a suburb, like the Isle of Wight. Welcome to the Desolation of Smaug.
Well, it is sort of.
You know, but I started thinking about it today, and it's like that whole little town Welcome to the Desolation.
The interesting thing is that we didn't quite get to the Desolation.
Yes, we did.
It was the history of his destruction of the Earth community.
No, what is it?
Isn't that what they referred to?
I haven't read this chapter hours.
The dwarf does refer to the desolation of Smaug, and
desolation is the town.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
The destruction
granted.
Of the town. Yes. Right. That's what I just said.
Yeah, but no. Well, it's already desolated.
Yes,
when
I know. It's the past. Look at it. It's desolated.
Well, yes. Exactly.
This is the desolation of Smaug.
Yes.
But frankly, that isn't what were expecting.
We thought they were going to desolate Smaug.
I thought Smaug was going to be doing some
part
desolation.
I thought he was going to be desolated.
Not if you know your Tolkien.
Yeah, well.
Well,
B,
I don't.
Not if you know your English.
But I thought it was
desolation
going to be.
Desolation means the woe.
Yes, I know, but I thought it was going to be Smaug's woe and sadness at being defeated by our stalwarts. But of course, how I could expect that to happen in part two.
People confuse the
word
desolation and destruction.
Well, he would be somewhat desolated were he to have his gold taken away and be cast from the pit.
Yes, well, maybe.
Although I have to say one thing about
that never happened.
The whole Smaug effect is for years. I mean, in all of mythology and everything, all the talk of dragons and their gold. Yeah. I have to say that for the first time, watching him buried among all those gold coins,
you bought it.
I understood the nature. It was so sensual. It was like the way. It's like a quilt of gold. He just buried in. If it got a little cool, he could blast a little flame through.
As Dan pointed out,
warm them up and dive in.
The imagery of Smaug.
Brilliantly beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful.
So very good imagery. Very good CG animation.
Wonderful
of the dragon. Beautiful vocal by Benedict.
Absolutely. And
Cumberbatch.
Hours and 47 minutes.
What? Yeah. Mistakes of Cumberbatch? Oh, technical mistakes?
No, technical. Where it's like, oh my God, that was a puppet. You know, and then they cut away. That was a practical one.
And you get to see the discussion in the edit room. It's like, is it worth the $10 million? It's 2 seconds. The five people who notice it will have fun telling their friends about it. And they just let it go.
Even
when
you are not aware of it or looking for it, which I wasn't. My partner and I, we looked at each other and went, yeah, I saw that.
Yes,
that was like going back to Willow. It was...
Weirdly, it was... I thought it was worse.
It takes
you out
of the movie.
Yeah, just generally. I mean, in terms of the special effects, it was worse.
Because they are so great.
Did you see the first Hobbit in HFR?
No. I saw it in IMAX 3D.
Yes, I've only seen them both in IMAX 3D.
The mating of the special effects, the CG special effects, to the live action stuff, I felt was worse in the first film. They seem to have learned some sort of lesson from that film to this. One would hope. But
Weta is ongoing. It's interesting to note that Jim Rigel,
I suspect he'll be better in the re-release,
is not the, who was on this show, as a matter of fact, is not the special effects guy in charge here. I had Jim Rigel on Hour of the Wolf, and it's 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. He spent an hour just talking about the creation of Treebeard.
Just the nostrils it was on the dragon alone.
It was fascinating.
The left nostril, I will now speak on
but
for 90 minutes.
My problem with the movie is if you go for all three options, and let me explain to listeners what the options are.
Okay.
First, you have a large screen 2D movie. I don't know too many places that are playing that. Out of town, yes. Out of town.
But we're in New York. Out
of town. You know, yeah. And people are listening to us right now across the world.
Out there in the
through
sticks.
The internet.
Watching it.
I happen to know we have somebody from in Bulgaria listening. And very often we have people in, we've had people from WIDA listening. I once had somebody from WIDA call up where right now it's mid-morning.
Yes.
Why wouldn't they be listening? There's this thing called
be working.
There's this thing called the internet, and they can call in through Skype. At any rate, there's the high frame rate, which apparently, I did not see it with the first film, but apparently caused a lot of people to feel very edgy.
It's like blip phones. They can have audience people blowing up in their seats halfway through the screens.
These are the reviews. I'm overstimulated. Of the time.
Let me say, I didn't feel edgy. I felt unhappy. I
think the term for some of the people was they felt queer.
Well, there you go.
Seriously, and that's a proper use of the word.
There would be.
This is not so much a problem with the second film. They've changed how they project the HFR.
So it's not actually nauseating the
audience. Means the normal movies are projected at 24 frames per second. And this film is projected at 48 frames per second.
Now, I haven't...
And I found the imagery to be crisp and more enjoyable.
Well, literally, you're getting twice as much data.
The problem with it was, and I still think the problem is here with this film, is that there is that this is a 3D film.
I'm trying to outline what the three
options are. Finish up, my man.
The second option is IMAX. Whether you see it on a super big screen, which gives you an eyeful. Now, the great late Paul Wunder of WBAI had a wonderful formula for the perfect seat for any movie, which is one screen length away. If you are watching a movie on a 70-foot screen, you should be 70 feet away. He could tell you, by the way, what that was at the Lowe's Astra Plaza and what that was at the Ziegfeld. He knew that, and various screening rooms.
Okay.
He knew them all. And it's perfect because what it does is it fills your image.
Put you equally distant right in the center. It's a nice...
Pardon me. It brings the image right up to your peripheral vision, but not beyond the peripheral vision, meaning that... And this is important. You can move your head, still see the movie, and this is very important for feeling engaged. There was a psychological study about television and the technology of television in which they said one of the problems is you can't turn your head to focus on the screen because in those days, the screens were, you know, at most 20 inches.
Right.
IMAX, you don't have any such option. Basically, my formula for that is about two-thirds of the way toward the top should put you
that's,
level.
That's about right.
About the same.
That's
yeah,
about
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And but that will more than that will fill your peripheral vision
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
So that has the problem of total engagement. And then third option is, of course, 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So HFR 3D IMAX means that if you turn your head at all, even slightly, the image starts becoming out of focus.
Now, is that because of the high? Because I've not had that in just 3D IMAX.
I've not had a problem.
It's just a high frame rate issue. That's
what I am.
It's the combination of all three.
What I am discovering is that with the HFR, it's as much a different way of thinking about how you're watching the film. Steve Bedrowski, when we were talking about this on the podcast, he had pointed out it's like a window.
Which podcast?
That is the CineFantastique Spotlight. That's up every Monday at cfqonline.com.
com.
Com.
Did you notice that on one, I actually elongated your voice on that?
You, no, I didn't.
Yes, I actually did that. Oh, I made it .com.
I was digitally private.
I faded out after about 6 seconds.
There was one where I said, did I do it that long? I wasn't that sure.
No, but you didn't.
You could actually meditate.com.
Yes, that's it. It's a bit of the alms.
And I don't always edit your thing, so that's why you hear the slating at the beginning and stuff like that. So, but the .com became a trademark, becoming a trademark, and I decided, okay, I'm listening. I was in the middle of editing a podcast, as a matter of fact.
So you just stretched me out.
I saw, as it were. I stretched out your calm. You were becalmed, at any rate.
In any way,
what happened to me and my partner and a number of other people in the theater is that we were so focused on that screen throughout the movie, we were literally entranced. And about 2 hours of this, we were fading. And it was an afternoon screening. It wasn't that we hadn't gotten enough sleep. It was just this barrage.
I was going to say, your brain is having to do an enormous amount of work.
Exactly.
Probably burned off a few calories on the plus side.
Yeah, I mean...
But I think what you're doing is you're trying... Here again, I think it's a different way of watching an HFR film than watching a film projected at 24 frames per second. We were talking about... And this struck me as well when I was watching the film, that the experience is more like looking through a window.
Yes.
Than watching the film.
But the point is, when you're looking through a window, your eyes are allowed to move across the vista of what's through that window. Yeah. Not so when you're watching an IMAX film.
Yeah.
And that is the point, is that the three options together as one are...
We should point out that you keep saying IMAX. You did not see real IMAX. Okay?
They have the logo.
But it's a smaller screen.
Right.
It's what I call FOMAX.
And it's technical IMAX in that it's the projection system.
Yeah.
And it is their trademark.
It's the IMAX trademark.
But it is not the scale that you would get at the Lincoln Center.
Yeah. When I worked at Liberty Science Center and we had OmniMax, which means that it was
12 stories tall instead of 5.
And it was a dome screen.
It was a dome screen. In order to go into the projection room, you had to go through two chambers, including one that just blew lint.
What were those scrub downs they did to Cher and
the
Streep in that movie?
The projector was actually in the center of the auditorium, wasn't it?
No.
No, wasn't it? That's no. That's
thinking
the way
of a
I
planetarium.
Remember.
No. I ate lunch there every day.
Oh, okay. I'm wrong.
So because
I was the IT director.
Because any dust would interfere with the projection of the image or the machinery itself.
I think that IMAX film is exposed to the open air.
Is it even film anymore?
Time.
I was going to say, because now it's all
digital. Now it's probably digital.
It's
probably digital. But
diggity, diggity.
Certainly Lord of the Rings was filmed using digital, what's the red...
I don't think it was using red cameras.
It was using whatever cameras. I do believe it was using the James Cameron system because Cameron was talking Jackson into using the HFR.
Yeah. Okay. So system. At any rate, so that Jackson could do the beta before Avatar 3 comes out.
I keep on thinking of Jackson and James Cameron as the two brothers up on the roof of their house, one boy with the umbrella, and the older brother is going, "You can do it. You can fly. Yeah. Just jump off." You know.
The caveat that I have is don't go see all three options, whether it's true IMAX or not, in one, because your brain really is going to work that much harder to take that all in. And we started phasing out about 2 hours into the film, which is just when Smaug is coming on.
And
let me
and you're all passing out.
And, Exactly. It was an eyeful. It was.
It
obviously
sounds like an argument for mental enhancement, like dropping by, some serious
by the way,
acid first.
The rest of the stuff, you could stay out of the theater for the first 2 hours of the film and go in for the last hour. That's what you're paying your money
for. Well, if
for.
You're a Tolkien fan, you will appreciate some of the niceties. Beorn is well done, although they cut out most of that adventure. But I have to agree with that cut. Mm-hmm. Because really very little happens in there that isn't like the opening of The Hobbit, which is where the dwarves show up two by two and Gandalf is telling the story, which we've already heard the story. So, yeah, but they cut out a lot of the Beorn, but at least they kept him in. They didn't cut him out the way they did Tom Bombadil. And the barrels sequence is totally faithful and very nicely done, although it's totally different. What's his name, the fellow who's eventually going to, spoiler, kill Smaug, is...
Thank God you said what's his name, so I don't know who you're talking about.
Does not appear in the book until, you know, pretty close to the demolition, if you will, of Smaug. He's not a main character. They bob right into the master of Lake Town's keeping and are immediately hailed as the return of, you know, son of Thrain and Thror, and are given full support of the people of Lake Town. So there are differences in the plot. That's nitpicking.
who proceed to encourage them to slay the dragon, much as...
But that is not the
Peter
problem.
Jackson was urged to use James Cameron's photographic system. No, you can jump off the roof.
With
go
the
ahead.
Movie, and I figured out where this problem came from.
Don't kill the
I
dragon.
Do not know this for a fact.
Yes.
I think his name, it's not Bond. It's
James.
Something like that. It's the guy. It's a guy.
Oh, that guy.
It's a guy in Lake Town that, in the movie, is the one who rows the hobbits, the dwarves, into Lake Town and smuggles them in.
The guy who with the spear, or the arrow, the,
well, yeah, the guy,
our little guy who guy, obviously has to kill Smaug because it's all been laid out in part two that this is his destiny and it's the only way he can redeem himself.
It is Bilbo who enables him to do that.
Well, at kindly Bilbo.
At any rate, well, not so kindly because that turns the dwarves against him. But anyway,
well, don't be giving things away.
A lot of people have read this book.
Well, Bard. Bard.
Too, but
Bard.
Okay, so...
Thank you, IMDb.
So let me just... there we go. A little late, but I got it. Turn your head and cough.
I did that before, but it didn't seem satisfying. Yeah, it hurts.
And when you turn your head and cough, don't mind what Dan is doing to you. But anyway...
are we getting queer again?
Get a funny feeling.
The first time is always uncomfortable, but don't worry about it. Yes, you're going to love it.
We have two movies in one, and this is my theory, which is mine, and it's a good one. It's a damned good one.
Your theory.
There is tons of bloat.
Yes.
In the first and second film.
Yes.
And then I remembered something at the end of the second film. Going through the credits and remembering a few things was that Guillermo del Toro was the original director of the film, and it had been announced when the project was first announced that he was going to do two movies.
Right.
And in those two movies,
the first film
was going to be The Hobbit.
Yes.
And the second film was going to be events.
An elaboration upon...
Of different things taken from the Silmarillion and the appendices of Lord of the Rings and put together.
Which, fine. Good. Rankin Bass did the entire Hobbit in 90 minutes.
They left a lot out. But...
But didn't really suffer for it.
And one of the things they left out was decent animation.
Well, that's another thing. But
did we not say Rankin Bass?
Yes, exactly. Actually, they did good film credits in the early 60s.
For specific circumstances. Didn't they do The Point?
Yes, they did.
I mean, there are certain things.
The point. No.
No?
Oh, Steele. No. At any rate, let me make my point.
Oh, finish.
Which is...
He's got a point.
No. Indeed. Well, last week, Nielsen. While I was playing the Council of Elrond on the air, I remember that in the Lothar movie, the Council of Elrond lasts about 2 minutes long. Last week on this program, it was 91 minutes. Now, the Tolkien takes 91 minutes to read aloud. It's a long, meaty chapter of about 35 pages. And what Jackson did is rather than have everybody come to the Council of Elrond and tell who they were and what their adventures were and stuff like that, is he shows it in real time. He changes some of the timing. For example, Gandalf's adventure with Saruman, and it's Saruman, not Saruman, with Saruman is, you can make faces, but don't forget, I was on the phone.
It's just the time I've heard you say it. It's like, I know, Jim. Yes. I know.
Well, I'd like to
you
tell
said
the
it before. Yeah. I'm sure you've mentioned it to them once or twice.
A lot.
I know Tolkien. I've talked to Tolkien. Tolkien was my friend.
I talked to Tolkien.
I know you did.
Okay, I tell everybody.
Not he speaks arguing. To you in your dreams. We all know this.
Okay, at any rate, the point is that what Jackson did was that he took the story, which in the novel is all told in flashback, and he told it in real time, mm-hmm. so that he could cut away from the adventures of the four hobbits and go to the wizard stuff like that.
It makes perfect sense. And grammatically, it's
very
smart.
It does make perfect sense.
I'm sure that's exactly
so it. Here's my guess. He took the two movies that Del Toro wrote, and he concatenated them into one. What we are seeing, all the bloat that we perceive, is the second movie that Del Toro was going to make is folded in to this. The whole story with Azog, the necromancer, which, by the way, is never in The Hobbit, though. Yeah. There is a mention of a necromancer in like chapter 2, lasts under a paragraph, and it is never identified as being Sauron. Spoilers.
This is the problem with the films, and quite frankly, with Lord of the Rings, he was fine in sort of stretching out the world and elaborating on Middle Earth and all of that, because you felt the direction, and he was staying relatively faithful to the way novels were laid out. In this particular case, he's dragging in stuff that doesn't belong in the film. My take on it, and here
Sylvester
again...
Sylvester McCoy? The Eighth Doctor?
Radagast the Superfluous? Yes, indeed.
Yes. Actually, he belongs in Lord of the Rings, and he's not in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was what surprised me about the Council of Elrond, is that he's referenced during that particular
cast. Saruman says Radagast the Brown in this disparaging way. Yeah.
That's why he wasn't invited.
The thing is, and we talked about this here again in the podcast, was that there used to be a Peter Jackson who said, you know what? Tom Bombadil doesn't really advance the story in any way. We don't really need him.
Yeah,
Peter Jackson
doesn't
exist.
I agree with
that,
but I also think that Tom Bombadil should have gotten his own movie.
Well, perhaps, do a spinoff for certain.
There are many stories of Tom Bombadil, which are not even in Lord of the Rings. There are poems, songs, and stories.
Do that instead of spinning off The Hobbit into three freaking movies.
Oh,
which
you think
it
they won't.
Before we even get to the extended edition.
The extended edition of part one is 3 hours, 3.5 hours?
It's 3.5 hours. I have to say, I like the extended edition of Lord of the Rings.
Okay, well,
because
you
know
what?
Because you have 8 hours of your life
the extended
to spend watching
edition?
It's 13.
Oh, geez,
remember, I sit through the ring cycle.
Yes. Oh, well. And but,
same.
Not all at once.
Yeah, but same source material. Excuse me.
I've not.
Next
you
month,
have.
We will be playing the whole thing at once, as we do every year.
But in that case, it takes 3 hours for a character to die in those things, so.
No, well, no, they die quickly. They just lead up to it forever. Yes, but anyway,
that's the point.
Not Zygmunt. Anyway, all that aside, yeah, Siegfried. Zygmunt actually dies with no Zygmunt. Zygmunt dies
Zygmunt
with
Sieglinde.
Blutenschwester dies with a single tap of Wotan's spear.
Serves him right.
Well, for what? For, you know, stooping his sister? Which is what?
Granted, it gets you a reality show nowadays, but in those days, they kind of frowned
on. This was the eugenics.
What is it that Anna Russell said about Siegfried? Like, there was only one woman that Siegfried came across.
She's the only woman that he has ever met who wasn't his aunt.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
That's Gutrune.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can do the whole thing, but we always play, by the way, the Anna Russell between Acts 2 and 3.
One almost must.
It's part of the BAI tradition. And, by the way, it's President's Day is when we do it, and we've been doing it since about 1963. We play the whole ring. Mm. I got to produce it for 2 years. My narrator 1 year was Tony Randall, which was a lot of fun. He was a hoot and a holler. And boy, was he into this stuff. He had no notes.
Well.
He didn't need them.
That
does not surprise me.
You know, and he was very clever and very funny and very irreverent.
Some network was doing an Odd Couple marathon today, which I stumbled across. I haven't seen the Odd Couple in over a decade. It was very strange.
At any rate, the movie, I would tell people... wait for the DVD.
Yeah,
I was going to say, why don't we talk about the movie instead of the technology of the movie? I mean, the story I found.
Well, because my problem with the movie was the technology.
Was the technology, I know. But we've gotten through
that. My point is that, are you sure it was the technology or was it just the bloat?
The movie was just
stultifying. No, I've sat through bloated films before and not almost fallen asleep. This was hypnotizing. Now, it's only, I think, the combination of three, which is only available in one theater, and now that it's January 2nd, may no longer be available even in that theater on West 34th Street.
Because they've all made way for the 47 Ronin.
Yes.
Not true.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I did.
And
actually quite good.
The trailer was great.
I read this horrible thing that was like saying it's a bomb. It only made $20 million across the state.
People say that the moment they hear the name Keanu Reeves, substituted Keanu with Kevin Costner.
You want to hear my favorite joke?
It was like,
I'll give you my favorite joke. This is from Zach Galifianakis. I won't do it exactly, but this is close enough. The joke is, one of the things that I really like to do is go to the worst movie available in a theater in the middle of the day. You go into that theater and there is one person sitting there. So I'll go into the theater and I'll sit right next to the person. And the person will turn to me and go, excuse me? And I'll go, shh, I can't hear Keanu.
Right.
Oh. I love that.
I mean, he was okay in some films. I don't despise Keanu Reeves.
He is Keanu Reeves in this, but it turns out that the film is actually a nicely done, actually Hong Kong style movie. That's essentially what it is. It's this mashup.
Well, I mean, just watch White Serpent.
History.
I mean, it's like
I believe it's actually made in Hong Kong.
And a few
Kong,
others.
It was a Japanese production actually.
Oh, okay.
And
given the story matter, yeah.
But it was filmed on location in Budapest.
Yes.
Which does actually look like
Shogun
version?
Japan.
If you include the Robert De Niro?
It's like the Ronin is something. That's something else. Good film also, by the way.
Yeah,
I believe actually there were four other versions.
Including a silent.
If you add them all up, you get 47 of them.
There you go.
I didn't know about the silent version.
Yeah, well, it seems from.
Oh.
You know, because it's early silent, so it's probably two reels.
Yeah.
And a lot of jumping around. And the idea is that together, you already know the story.
Oh, yes, because everyone in the 20s knew the story of the
47. I mean, that's what they used to do in those days. They'd do a scene from Dickens, they'd do a scene from
but
Shakespeare.
But was the 47 running that well at that time period?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because of the 20s, Orientalism, for about, all that sort of...
And for about 300 years
fascination
before
Fascination with the East in America?
It's a and Japan was very advanced in cinema.
In any case, it's not a great film, but I went into it thinking, well, you know, the film is opening on December 25th. This is not the type of film you open on December 25th.
Well, there's a... I mean, they never used to open movies on Christmas Day.
They did. Oh, yes. They did when they wanted to get in audiences before the critics could have their say.
Right.
About the film.
Well, I think it's, when I say never, I mean it's a phenomenon that's maybe 10 years old at most.
No, it actually goes longer than that. Yeah. But what has happened...
Where I was growing up in Queens,
the Star Wars releases for Christmas?
No, May 17th, every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always May 17th.
What has changed now is that...
That's what created the summer
blockbuster Star Wars. In addition to December 25th being the dumping grounds for films... that they think will attract the audience.
It's the soundtrack of The Hobbit.
In the background, is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Sorry, it was just so low. It's like, is there
you're hearing
an orchestra?
You're
in the
hearing
next
music.
Room? Yeah, I'm
hearing. It's either that or you're falling in love.
There you go.
There you go. Okay.
Very low and in my right ear is very odd.
The December 25th was the dumping ground, but now what has happened more often is that it's also the place where they open films where they feel it might be a contender for the Academy Awards, even if it will not.
Because they get it in just in
like
the
Saving
end
Mr.
Year.
Banks.
Get it in
right under the wire.
You get it in, get it in a
theater. A film like 47 Ronin, where they essentially say, we don't know how to sell this to the American public.
Yeah,
but at that point, why are you spending $200 million making it? I mean, if
for
you can't
everywhere,
because
figure
it makes
it
money.
Out, this film is then, going to be a blockbuster everywhere. But
which
the United
Johnny
States.
Johnny Mnemonic was as well for the same reason. They made that for an Asian market audience to a large degree. Look, I know the executive one of the executive producers.
Oh,
that movie got
I
changed
hear that
completely
excuse.
Because they wanted to appeal to that.
But you know why that movie is important? It proves that William Gibson does not know how to write a screenplay. But
no, it proves more about the studio system and its machinations and how things get made in Hollywood. And we'll have that discussion later.
Because Gibson can write
a screenplay, but that was not the screenplay Gibson wrote.
That's the only one
that was made.
He's the only one he's ever written.
Yeah. Not true. But X-Files. William Gibson wrote for X-Files a couple of episodes.
But nonetheless, don't judge Gibson's scriptwriting abilities by the final script of the movie.
Yeah.
That was not what he
but
had
he's,
made.
But I
know all the stories.
His material is better when somebody else adapts it, such as the totally unknown, although Dan will know, New Rose Hotel, which was directed by
Abel
Ferrara.
I think it was. Well,
The power of
he's not using a phone. He's got IMDb in his head.
The power of trivia in our brain.
I'm chucking that way. They have implanted IMDb in my cranium.
Yes, exactly. The upgrades are painful, though. And the ads. Oh God! But anyway, of course the Matrix. The initial concept of the Matrix is a Gibson ripoff. And no, it wasn't that.
And by the last two, it was just Jerry Silverman.
Oh, it dies. Joel Silverman. It dies the moment that he goes to see the Oracle.
I just remember sitting
you
in the movie.
You called it, sir, Abel Ferrara.
During the second one and just watching that moment where he's
film.
In the room with the architect.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen
it's
it.
It's really obscure, beyond belief.
Yeah.
But Gibson's best material, in my humble opinion, is... his short stories, not his novels. His short stories. Stories like New Rose Hotel, one of his best, Burning Chrome, which is not a Google reference. But the collection of stories, Burning Chrome.
It would be... No, I'm
it's
just
among his
making
best
it,
writing.
No, it's the pun on Google.
Yes.
Okay. Making the face about.
Burning Chrome. It's putting it onto
it
your
sounds desk. Like another, like, you know, I saw a doc about Google's books thing that was on Al Jazeera America, which was just making it seem as much like the evil empire as anything could be. So Burning Chrome would be the sequel to that one, where they're just going on and taking over the world completely.
Yeah, yeah.
Which would be easier if anyone would sign up to Google Plus.
Benevolent companies like Microsoft and Apple.
Oh, hey, look, you know, I'm not saying anything about any of that, but
I am.
I'm just saying that Google would be a lot easier to take over the world than get anyone to sign up for Google Plus, other than the 50 of us that are there.
Google Plus, what? Google Plus is a great
Thank
place
you.
To be if you're
if you don't want to be interrupted
by anyone else.
Yes,
<that's,
laughs> you don't want to be bothered.
It's a fortress of solitude.
It's
friendly.
A lovely thing.
No,
although the Hangouts, I'm a member of a Black A writing group that's, you know, suspended workshops, and we're going to try and do Google Hangouts to continue the writing workshop.
Yeah,
The bandwidth is available.
That's the doing of a technology writer.
It's a lovely thing.
And that's the point. The technology writer audience and the geek audience is huge. And they are on Google Plus. And if you go there and you write about that kind of a thing, I get dozens of shares within minutes. I get a bigger reception to a tech story on Google Plus than I do on Facebook.
Social media for Silicon Valley.
So MySpace is for musicians. Google Plus is for geeks.
Yes.
I'm still sort of fascinated by how easily we all did re-embrace geek as a statement of power as opposed to anything else.
It was originally
more than I'm comfortable with the N word.
It's a term
that was used for science
fiction readers.
Yeah, no,
I proudly
proclaim myself a geek. I mean that I embrace. You know, I'm proud of my technological ability to make my equipment work.
Yeah. So anyway, we've only covered one of three movies.
I know.
We barely even talked about the Hobbit. We spent half an hour discussing this projection. Sorry to sound self-centered here, but yes. I did do the review of Her.
And we haven't even played it
yet. Yes, indeed.
You're so scum. Why don't we move on to that?
How long is it?
It's four minutes.
I was going to say, if it's more than that, screw it. We're not playing it. You just have to tell us while you're sitting in the room.
Sing it.
Da-dum-da-dum-dum-dum. You'll say it, but I'll close my eyes so I don't actually see you say it.
There we are.
Actually, it's appropriate to play the review of Her out of a speaker and not actually see a human being saying it.
Stand by. Well, I would.
Of course, that's the home
listener's. I would love to get Scarlett Johansson's
perception of the whole thing. You know, it's funny though. I really enjoyed her so much in that movie. And I usually find her vaguely irritating. It's
one
like,
of her sexiest roles ever.
Because I'm not having to look at her trying to look sexy. And because I was watching commercials for
the Avengers, man.
She's lovely in that. But I mean, I was watching a commercial for that movie with the new thing that she's in. With what's his name from Third Rock. And, you know, the scenes that she's doing.
What's his name? You mean the former arts director of WBAI, John Lithgow? Yes.
No. The kid.
Oh, I know.
She's in a movie with.
I don't care about anybody but Lithgow.
Oh, no, I love him, and I can't think of his name right now. But at any rate, she's in it, and she's doing all this sexy, cutesy stuff, and it's irritating the hell out of me.
Shall we hear the review?
Please!
Okay.
You invited an ADHD guest.
We'll be back.
You have to expect a few digressions.
I'm just going to fade down those other two microphones and remind people that this is WBAI in New York City. The program was Hour of the Wolf, and we'll be back in about 4 minutes.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And wow, big love out there for director Spike Jonze's new film, Her. Big, big love for the story of Theodore, a sensitive but damaged man, played by Joaquin Phoenix, living in a near-future Los Angeles, who installs a new artificial intelligence operating system into his home computer, a kind of super deluxe Siri, voice performed by Scarlett Johansson, and finds himself falling in love with the device, and the machine reciprocating. And for that, the praises come. We're talking top 10 lists here, Oscar buzz, the whole bit. And it can't be argued that Her isn't a good film, because it is. Joaquin Phoenix delivers a nuanced, empathetic performance in a film that rests largely upon his shoulders. That's mostly him, on screen alone, talking to a disembodied voice. His performance is matched in quality by a largely female supporting cast that includes Amy Adams, Rooney Mara, and of course, Johansson, who, voicing the role of the computer that dubs itself Samantha, manages to be both warm and human, yet with a kind of otherworldly veneer. And for his part, director Spike Jonze demonstrates his skill at creating a near-future world that's visually beautiful and yet still credible. You can imagine that people would actually live in this future, albeit people at the upper half of the economic scale, maybe. Technology is deployed with understated intelligence. Jonze avoids the trap of gumming his tech up with visual glitz. If Apple has taught us anything, it's that the evolution of technology tends towards smaller, sleeker, less intrusive, and Jonze reflects that design sense here. That kind of intelligence suffuses the entire story. This is not a dumb film, and Jonze, who also scripted, gives genuine thought to how the details of a doomed love story would be altered when one of the participants clocks her life in fractions of a second and lives in constant connection with the limitless geography of the web. But you see, that's where I have my problems. Turns out that what her is that doomed love story, except now it's human and computer, and that's it. The science fiction element is more contextual than truly integral. You're supposed to go, oh, I get it, nothing's really changed. But then what? For all the smarts that Jonze invests in his story, there's nothing truly insightful or daring or dangerous to the concepts he's toying with. A sequence where Samantha tries to rescue her faltering relationship with Theodore by instigating a threesome between her, her human lover, and a third flesh-and-blood woman winds up being merely awkward and unconvincing, rather than truly unsettling or, more promisingly, disturbingly erotic. This is a science fiction film for people who don't much like science fiction, for people who can find worth in the genre only when it's used to inform a more conventional concept. You remember how critics fell all over themselves praising Star Trek IV because it brought the franchise to present-day Earth? It's that kind of thing. For some people, without that kind of grounding, it's all sci-fi silliness. To take the premise and truly propagate out its repercussions, in this case, how an entity that's intangible and electronic would actually regard a relationship with an all-too-corporeal human and vice versa, that would just be too much. And that's what I find so frustrating about her and Spike Jonze's work in general, that this much skill and intelligence and elegance is being invested in something that doesn't push past the initial novelty of its premise, that doesn't truly explore the repercussions, but settles for its serving as commentary for something we've seen before, we know already. Jonze is a smart man and a skilled filmmaker. Clearly, he's satisfied with this film being what it is. And again, this is a good film. But it could have been wiser, more innovative, more challenging. There's a lot to praise in her, but at the risk of sounding ungrateful, there's also so much more that it could have been, that its creators are clearly capable of providing, but just don't feel inclined to. It's working for them. Clearly the praise is there, and not really undeserved. But I wish, finally, that Jonze and those who work with him would take that extra step. I'm Dan Persons. If you love fantastic film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Okay.
Let's you and me wrestle.
Okay. Well, okay.
It's funny after having heard it talked about it.
That
then
we
hear
all agree that this is a fine film.
It's okay. A good film.
Well, we'll start
and I don't disagree.
But
go on.
Each have different takes.
And I don't disagree. The ending has flaws. It ended better than I feared it was going to at a certain point.
Well, there was
a point where it's like, oh God, no, it's not going to do that, is it?
And it didn't.
But it's almost at the anticipation of, and we probably have to warn people that there may be some spoilers in this conversation.
That's
mind
F of it.
Yes, but the thing is, though, that it's almost like the fear of the awful ending that it might have had is almost the camouflage to it not actually having an ending. I mean, in essence, it's an opening to a new beginning of what might happen next, which I think is not an invalid way for a movie to end. But essentially, and this is where I just want to warn anybody who hasn't seen the movie to stop listening now. But I feel compelled to discuss
spoiler alert.
I could just bring it down to that, yes. But, I mean, the basic... I like very much...
I need a cart of Alex Kingston just saying, spoilers.
Oh, that is spoilers. But, I mean, what I liked very much about the ending was the path that it took of literal... what's what I was trying to think of the other day? It's that bursting forth, that all the digital beings essentially transcendent. It was a literally transcendent ending in that all of these figures
right out of
that
Arthur C.
suddenly,
Clarke and Olaf Stapledon,
and many other, there's certainly, you know, precedent.
It's a great history of that in science fiction.
But the problem is that once they all go off and everyone's sort of left sitting there going, well, we're back with ourselves again, it's like, really? Shouldn't there be a better ending than that? And
no,
that's sort of the lack
of
it.
This is where I disagree.
But to me, it's like, you know, well, okay, that's a good thing. And now what we've learned is we have each other.
Yes.
And then we move on from there. And that's what the ending is.
Do you remember the other...
Is this little moment of not being sure where these characters are going, but knowing that they know they're on their own, but they can be on their own and move forward from that point.
Let me compare it to another movie that has a similar story arc.
Yeah.
And is not very well known at all. And I'm not going to talk about Simone or Simone. I'm talking about Cold Souls.
That's what we watched together.
Okay, yes. Cold Souls is a very appropriate comparison
to
this
the same
film.
World. Very much.
Because both movies use science fiction as no more than the device to tell an extremely human story.
Which is fine.
And they have the same ending.
I don't remember that much of Cold Souls to agree with you or not. I do understand that point, but
I wish I could say it's on Netflix, but it's not.
Sadly, not. It's actually really good.
You can get the disc from Netflix if you go whole hog, whole dollar.
But that is the exact problem with me is that the whole point about the relationship between the human and the computer in this film is, as I say, it's one of context. You're just sort of moving the furniture around and changing the.
It's not that. Let me tell you an old story. So there's a guy in like Eastern Russia, okay? And he goes to the rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, my house is way too small. There's no room and all this." And the rabbi says, "Take your pig into your house."
I know this story.
You know this story.
We probably all of us know this story.
Okay, next time he says, "Bring the cow into the house." Next time he says, "Bring blah, blah, blah into the house."
Putting things in.
He ends up there and he goes, "There's, you know, the cows are doing this and the sheep are doing this. There's no more room." And the rabbi says, "Take them all out of your house," and then the guy goes back to the rabbi and says,
"Oh my God,
you're a complete genius!
What a roomy house! I feel fabulous."
Yeah, so it's the same story being presented in a new context so that you see it in a new way.
That is the core.
Yeah, I understand the core. For me, that wasn't quite enough, and this comes after, frankly, I had seen this film after I had seen The Past, the new Asghar Farhadi film, which is not a genre film, it's a drama, but it's a drama about human relationships, and it had new things and challenging things to say about human relationships, whereas Her doesn't really have anything new to say.
And that's
about
where I disagree.
Human relations,
and that's where I disagree. Yes,
the very
probably
scene
a different scene
that you dislike devastated me. The one where the third, the woman, comes
the
in,
threesome,
the surrogate.
The threesome, yes.
Yeah, well, you see, there's the question. Was it a threesome or was it voyeuristic? How is it that this woman can possibly totally be in love with Joaquin Phoenix, or anybody for that matter, who's wonderful in the film, Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, he's amazing.
He's very good. Yes, he is very good.
I don't think anybody's going to fault the performances.
No.
She has never met him, and yet She is already in love with him immediately. Why? Because somehow we know that Samantha, which is the Scarlett Johansson
character, has been in correspondence with her and filling her in.
Yes, and this is, by the way, a clue to there's a lot more going on in that relationship than poor Joaquin. I forget the character's name. Is it Christopher?
Theodore Twombly.
He's almost completely anonymous, but it's like
straight out of Henry Kuttner's stories.
But the thing is, she isn't in love with him. She's in love with them. She says that very clearly. I love you guys.
Yeah.
She's in love with being the portion of a relationship that can't be fulfilled in any other way.
Yeah.
Which is what I found fascinating about that portion of it. Because what it to me did was it posited new social constructs.
Yes.
And to me, that's what I always find. I mean, to me, science fiction that's the most interesting is the stuff that shows how what could be developed in the future redevelops us and how it changes us and how we relate to each other or it. Because, I mean, and it does the same thing. I mean, there was that dreadful sort of movie with Robin Williams years ago, Centennial Man, I think.
Bicentennial Man.
Oh, it was dreadful.
It wasn't a great novel by Asimov.
I haven't read the novel. But the movie was just like, oh, God, I just want to tear my brain out. You know, but by the end, is this robotic creature who's been physicalized to the point of seeming human, who then develops a relationship with a human being who's the descendant of the people who built him in the first place.
Yeah, that's a valid comparison.
And it's a love story that develops over time. And by the end, machine and... One of the things I found most fascinating about the movie, about her, was at the point where the relationship starts to come out, where he's actually telling people he's having a relationship with an AI, or as he puts it, an OS, and no one's responding to this in any way other than...
The double date with him and his co-worker
and his co-worker's girlfriend and him and his LS on the box, and the fact that the two guys go off to chat about the relationship and the two girls are chatting with each other.
Exactly.
But they're making jokes. I mean, that blew me away.
It's like, oh my God. I see that sort of nonchalance in the people's acceptance as a flaw of Spike Jonze instead of exploring the concept.
I do see it as exploring the
confronting
concept.
Basically, what he's trying to do is he's trying to tell the story of a doomed relationship. It's a somewhat comic story, but he's doing it in the context of a human and a computer rather than two humans.
It's doomed only because she transcends it. And remember the last words, how much he loves her. It's doomed because one lover outgrows the other. Which is, okay, but here are key points to the film. Some major, one trivial, but not so trivial. The major one is at the beginning of the movie, it's made clear that he has been going through a divorce, and this guy has relationships. He creates relationships. His job is that he writes
often
love
being
letters,
both sides of a
and
relationship.
He's been both sides of the relationship.
I mean, he's involved with a couple that he's written all their correspondence.
Yeah, I mean, he is the love letters from both people in a relationship, and yet he is totally unable to talk to his own soon-to-be ex-wife. He cannot communicate with her. He cannot have a relationship with her. That is beyond his means.
Which to me is almost an ironic cliche, of course, the man who can be published writing love letters can't be in love.
The point of the movie. Because after, first, by the way, very important to note, and this is the obscure point, is when Samantha, she says, well, have you been seeing other people? Well,
642 I'm in love with. I love that. That was fascinating.
4,000 or 5,000 people. She introduces him to one.
Who's an AI.
But who is he?
It's Alan, what's his name?
Watts.
Right.
Of WBAI.
But he's a philosopher. And yes. What kind of a philosopher is he? I couldn't put a word to it, but my feeling in the movie was that this is her way of opening up the door to her new life to get him to understand where she's headed.
But
I actually looked at Alan Watts as more the tennis pro in the narrative. And
No, he isn't. Yes, he was a philosopher who wrote a great deal about transcendence.
Right.
Transcending,
which is where it all starts.
Your life, transcending your love, and taking your love to the next level with your partner. Now, Alan Watts provided the religious programming for WBAI. It was merely philosophy, but radio stations in them days, in the 60s,
perceived it as religious.
It was in FCC rules and regulations that you had to provide a certain amount
of
religious or philosophical programming. Yeah. Alan Watts recorded about 30 or 40 hours, all of which is available on the web at alanwatts.org. That was produced at our sister station, KPFA. It had KPFK, because it had to be LA. And we broadcast it every morning during my announcing shift. So I have heard more than a little Alan Watts. And what he... Now, this is the obscure thing. But the point is that the content, the idea of, A, she's able to not only talk and deal with this transcendent philosopher, but B, it's Alan Watts 2.0.
Right.
And they can bring back anybody from the dead. She can have any mind she wants and go into the far reaches of the galaxy.
Well, to the degree they've been put online. Now,
let me just finish.
Okay.
Then, shortly after, all of the AIs depart Earth. And all of a sudden, people discover that they have to turn to each other. And here is Amy Adams, who has had, by the way, what a consolation prize, Amy Adams. Yeah, right?
They're worth secondhand.
All of a sudden, this guy who was unable to communicate to his wife, to his relationships, A, writes the most beautiful letter he has ever written, and it's to his wife. And he says how much of her is now a part of him. And
right.
Then he is able to start a new relationship with Amy Adams.
And well, okay. my feeling is that you could have told the same story without the computer.
Well, just would have been another woman, possibly, or secretary,
yes,
or something.
Yes.
But I disagree, though, to a certain level, because I think that that aspect of it brought in something else.
By the way, we have 2 minutes.
I know, which I'm trying to say this quickly. I disagree with your...
And in conclusion,
I disagree with the description of it as a doomed relationship. I see it as a relationship that one partner transcends but pulls the other with her. I mean, even though they're no longer involved, she's made him a better person. She's got him through. And the thing is, the other second point is...
On a technological level, there's no reason that she can't remain.
And come back and visit. But except that they sort of...
She can transmit!
Yeah, but they've moved on and we're behind them now and there's all that aspect.
By the way, you can go to our review podcast of that. I came up with a better ending for the film than that. You go into our spoiler section, you can listen to that.
But the thing is, I disagree that he couldn't... He had maintained... They show many images of the happy relationship of him and his wife. It fell apart. They grew apart, is what they say.
They grew apart. He could not communicate.
But the thing is that there had been a point where he could. They changed, and he could no longer communicate. And I think that part of the thing is that, in the same way with Samantha, she gets to a point where he can no longer communicate with her because he won't accept where she's going, which I think is the same issue with their living wife.
Except that I think the point is that he drew away from his wife as Samantha draws away from him. And once again, it's something that could be told without the computer.
I respectfully disagree with that. I thought it was perfect in that respect until something better comes along, which it may. But let me say this. For all three of us in this room, we all heartily recommend this movie.
Yes. I didn't get a chance to talk about Dr.
Okay. Yes. And it is such a good movie that we barely scratched the surface in the a best wonderful thing about argument.
It. Right. Now, the best thing about it was that it prompted a great deal of conversation even after we saw it. And
exactly.
continues to. And any movie that makes me think and consider other possibilities,
and
I
we weren't
I had
talking
to be
about
favor.
The technical aspects, which are fine, by the way.
Yes.
And so on.
Well, it was 2D.
So although, when it gets into
framework.
What an OS would do, when you restart your machine, it will be rebooted. It will not be absent. But
well, see, my
yeah,
thing
well,
is the,
yeah, that's the other
are,
thing.
Oh,
that's,
I mean,
I know it's not going to leave. You bought a freaking disc. I want a refund. It's my first that, thing. I'm going to the Apple
where,
store.
That's
and
where
saying,
I felt the story could have been improved. Once again, listen to our podcast.
I've
got a better ending for the film.
I actually expected the ending to be that he put the install disk back in, reinstalled the operating system, and Samantha with another name just appeared.
But
what I expected.
The only problem with that then is,
it
is that he
takes
would
you
not,
nowhere.
It, no, it's not. The point is that it's an artifice, agreed. But the reason for it is that he has to discover Amy Adams, who's been
absolutely.
There all the time.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing
that
is
too,
that I felt what could have happened, if you want to know, is that she could have grown beyond it and put in a version of herself that was more accommodating
to
him.
Yes.
He would have discovered.
And my question
is
why don't you limit the range of an AI's experience when you're programming the damn thing?
But that wasn't the purpose of the movie.
No, I
know
exactly.
It would have become the purpose if he had discovered the fact that this other version existed and then discovered that she had moved on to another life, and then he would have...
And left him with a cheap clone of herself.
Yeah.
It wasn't as
yeah.
bright. I would have felt really pissed at that.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
my wife leaves the real doll
you'd
in bed instead of her, and it looks just like
you'd
her.
You'd go
but
to the genius bar. That
yeah,
moment.
It really, it's just...
We our show ended a few minutes ago, as you can hear by the
But the film continues
the everybody
to inspire conversation.
Her, okay? It is, I think, one of the best movies of the year.
I'm waiting for the gay porn parody, him.
Right, well.
And if you got a little extra time, go and check out 47 Ronin, too. Couldn't
yeah,
wait.
No,
okay.
I...
And are you going to review that?
I'll review it next
Why
week.
Not? Why not?
Yeah, sure,
yeah.
sure.
Because you don't have anything else immediately.
I'm in favor
it's
of anything.
It's Paranormal Activity, and I don't
oh,
think
no,
you want
no,
it.
No,
oh, God.
I'll take 47 Ronin.
47 Ronin
you.
Next
Please,
week.
Much
yes.
more interested yes. To our listeners.
Thank
anything
you with a shape-changing witch I'm up for.
Thank you, Terrence
Thank you.
Taylor. Buy his books. Thank you, Dan Persons. Yes. Go to CFQ.com.
On CFQ Online.
And go to Do You Believe in
I forgot that.
Yes.
And do you believe in vampires.com for me?
Okay. And tune in next week where rumor has it that somebody else with a birthday, that being Richard Bowes, should be here. And a week after that, rumor has it, but not confirmed, Nancy Hightower. Again, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way to these airwaves momentarily. Good morning. And don't forget to and don't forget to come to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings this coming Tuesday. Go on Facebook and find out more.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red part of the balloon spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk.
wrong, or that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Right here at 99 Cinco WBAI. 99 Cinco WBAI, Lister on the radio from the top. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Clayton Downey on bass, Augustus Pablo's cousin. Yeah, let's get together. Happy New Year 2014, yo. In other words, let me translate. Traduzca, por favor. Get political.
Let's get together.
Or die.
Come on, let's